morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and I need to tell Patrice that I'm hearing an echo of myself about a second delayed or half second delayed in my headset. So that's distracting me. Anyway, for those of you out there who are not hearing that echo, I don't want to distract you with my being distracted. So I will give you the phone number, and if you want to be a part of this show, you can call. And you can ask any question you have about the Bible or the Christian faith. We can talk about it here. Or you can call with any disagreement you might have. And thank you, Patrice. That's fixed now. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And be glad to talk to you about, as I say, any issue that you wish to bring up, biblically or related to Christianity in any way. Let's talk first of all to Nelson, calling from Glendale, California. Nelson, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. It's a pleasure to talk to you. The question I have is, I have been a Christian for all of my life, and on and off over the years, 50-some years now, I've had people in the church relate the fact or state their idea that when this life is over, there's going to be some kind of a trial that occurs before the Almighty. And I can't find anything in the Bible that supports that. I can find repeated references to judgment, but I can't find anything that specifically says there's going to be some sort of a trial, an individual trial, you know, for each and every person. And I just wanted to get your opinion about that.
Well, you know, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 12 that every idle word that a man shall speak, he'll have to give account of it in the day of judgment, in Matthew 12:36. And so the day of judgment, I believe, is what you're referring to. You do see a judgment. But it says that a man's going to have to give account for every idle word he speaks at that. And so it seems like it's not only individual people, but individual things that are said by individual people considered. It says in Scripture, in Revelation 20, that when the great white throne was set up, and all the dead were brought up before God, and everyone was raised, it says that everyone was judged by their works, and rewarded according to their works, by the things written in the books. So I think the impression is very strong that there's individual judgment for individual actions in Scripture. You know, it says in 1 Peter 1, I think it's verse 17, 1 Peter 1, 17, if I recall correctly, it says, if you call him Father, who without partiality judges every man according to his works, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily mention the judgment day. It says God judges everyone according to his works. It doesn't mention the judgment day. It might be you could apply it to, you know, God judges people in this life according to their works. But like I said, Revelation 20 does talk about the same thing, only it applies it to the great white throne judgment. And Jesus talks about the day of judgment in which every idle word a person speaks will have to give account of. So I think that teaching is there.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with everything you say. I guess the inference that I've heard for all my life is that there was going to be a time when every individual would be able to substantiate what they did or didn't do in this life. And this idea of a trial, like we know a trial here on earth, you know, where you give evidence and rebuttal and all this, I didn't see that anywhere in the Bible. So, and I agree with you.
Well, right. I don't think the trial is going to be like our earth, like our... Okay. You know, our criminal courts, in the sense
right.
that that you give yourself, you give some kind of an answer for yourself or a defense for yourself.
Right.
You know, there's not going to be a prosecuting attorney and
right.
a defending attorney.
Right.
So, you know, but basically, God, the judge, or as he's described in some of the statements that Jesus made, the king. It's more like a king is calling his subjects before him. He knows what they've done. There doesn't mm-hmm. have to be any evidence provided other than what is already known to him.
Right.
And each one is to be rewarded according to his works, whether good or bad.
Okay, good, good. That's exactly what you just stated. What I understood. So, okay, that's good.
Okay.
You've helped a lot. Thank you very much.
Okay, Nelson. Thanks for your call.
All right.
Good talking to you. Oops, I sound like I cut him off when he's speaking. You need to know there's a slight delay when I'm talking to a caller. It's usually about a half a second, probably. So sometimes I'll hang up, but it doesn't hang up immediately, and the person will start to talk. So you get kind of a half a second as they're going off. It's an accidental hang up, not knowing. Well, I mean, I hung up on purpose. I didn't know they were going to say more. Let's talk to Tim from Lake Forest, California next. Tim, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Blessings, Steve. I had a question just regarding the accuracy of the Septuagint, and specifically Hebrews 10:5 and 10:37 and 38. It's completely different than our Masoretic text. I lead a small group on Isaiah, and I've been reading through the Septuagint, the English version,
mm-hmm.
and the differences are overwhelming in some areas.
Yeah, for Hebrews 10:5, where it says, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me. In the Masoretic text, the Hebrew, it says, but my ear you have opened,
yes,
or pierced. So there's definitely a difference there. The other verse you're talking about is in chapter 10, verse 38.
Yeah,
now the just shall live by faith.
Habakkuk. Yeah.
Yeah, in Habakkuk 2, 3 and 4, it actually says in the Hebrew, the just shall live by his faithfulness. And
where if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. That's
mm-hmm.
not in our text either. The Masoretic.
It's not. It's earlier in the verse. It's
okay.
Kind of confusing. I remember looking for it earlier. It says, I'm turning to it now. Just a moment here. Habakkuk 2:4.
No problem.
Yeah, it's. I think. Let's see here. Yeah, behold the proud. His soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. I believe the proud, his soul is not upright in him, is the part that the Septuagint has rendered quite differently, where it says, if anyone draws back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. I've looked at this before, and I'm trying to figure out, I think that is where it is.
Yeah.
But you're right, the Septuagint is quite different in some verses. And you know, the New Testament writers quoted the Septuagint a great deal as if they accepted it, although they also knew how to read Hebrew in all likelihood and
sure.
may have been familiar with the Hebrew text. The New Testament writers do not consistently quote the Septuagint, though the writer of Hebrews does. The writer of Hebrews never quotes from the Hebrew text. He always quotes from the Septuagint, and other New Testament writers frequently quote from the Septuagint, which makes it clear that for those who are listening and don't know what the Septuagint is, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which 70 Jewish scholars translated the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek about almost 300 years before Christ. And the Hebrew text that we have available to us today is called the Masoretic text. Now, of course, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls as well, and they are very close to the Masoretic text. But the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation made by the Jews centuries before Christ, differs in wording on a number of things. And I have to say, the settlement of that issue is difficult. Because one could argue that, you know, the Septuagint's a bad translation in those cases. Although one could also argue that when the Septuagint was made, they had earlier manuscripts of the Hebrew than what we have.
Yeah.
And so it's possible the Septuagint actually preserves what the earlier Hebrew manuscripts said, and that our Hebrew manuscripts, which come from a later period, are, you know, have been corrupted in those places. It's hard to say, and I don't know how to settle it. Now, for people who... Go ahead.
No, I'm in the same boat, Steve. It freaks me out because I've never really heard people teach from the Septuagint and talk about how
mm-hmm.
the Septuagint would say this and our Masoretic text says this, and it's blowing me away how messianic the Septuagint is.
Uh-huh. Well, it's true. I mean, a lot of passages in the Septuagint tend to render things, passages messianic that might not appear so much so in the others, in our Hebrew text as we have it. I don't know that it can be settled, you know, which is better. I would imagine that, it should be settled case by case. In other words, if you look at a particular scripture that reads differently in the Septuagint than it reads in the Masoretic text, you might have to take that as a separate case all to itself and say, well, which reading is most likely the original? And we may not be able to answer that question all the time.
Okay.
But I would say this, that even if the Septuagint, let's say, had made a mistake, let's say that the Masoretic text is more accurate on Psalm 40, where it says, a body you have prepared me. In the Septuagint, it says, my ear you have opened, or you've pierced my ear. Okay, suppose the Septuagint made a mistake and it's not a good translation. It seems to me that by the writer of Hebrews quoting it as authoritative, it at least gives that verse some kind of authority.
Yeah.
Because the New Testament quotes it that way. And it may very well be that the Septuagint does preserve the original reading better. But even if it doesn't, and even if it's a relatively poor translation, it's possible that a poor translation can still say something that's true and that someone would quote because they say, well, this is still a true statement. And so it's a hard call. You're asking a really hard question. I don't think any scholar can answer it with certainty, although I imagine most scholars have an opinion one way or the other.
I've gone to our pastor and I've asked the same thing, and he's like, man, you know what? I use the Septuagint when I study too, and I always give people the other alternative just so that they can see both sides.
That's what I think we have to do. When there's alternate readings, I mean, sometimes you can tell that one is a corruption and that the other is the original. Other times you can't tell which is the original, and I think the best you can do is just say, well, this one says this one says that, so one or the other is closer to the truth, but both of them seem acceptable anyway. You know, in others, there's nothing heretical in any of them. So, I mean, it's like you're not going to find a place where, you know, the Masoretic text says there's one God, Yahweh, and the Septuagint says, no, there's a whole bunch of gods, including Moloch and Baal and, you know, Zeus.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to find contradictions in theology, I don't think, between the different texts.
Okay.
I think you'll just find some different places where a phrase is different.
Really quick, without knowing Greek, is Brenton's English translation a decent translation of the Septuagint?
Vincent's?
Brenton. Brenton's.
To tell you the truth, I can't tell you.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a good translation, but if, you know, is it, who publishes it?
You know, I don't know. It's I have it on eSword. It's 1851, Brenton's English translation.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at the Septuagint right now on my shelf, and it's somebody called the Apostolic Press published this particular one, and I'm not seeing what the translator's name was here, so I can't really tell you.
That's okay.
Sorry, I wish I knew more. You'll have to talk to someone who really is a Greek scholar. I'm not.
Brother, I'm blessed by just your what you shared. I really, truly, it's very encouraging. So,
all right, Tim. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Good talking.
Bless you, Mike.
God bless you. Merry Christmas to you too. I think the same thing happened with that hang up. Sorry about that. Okay, the next caller looks like Dwone, unless there's a misprint, from Lake Elsinore. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hello.
Yes, who is this?
God bless you, Steve. This is Dwan from Lake Elsinore.
Dwan, yes, okay, great.
It's a pleasure to talk to you again. I've had the opportunity to listen to several of your lectures off of your website, and two in particular that I had a question in regards to were the ones entitled, Is There a Future Tribulation? Mm-hmm. I've, like I said, listened to them both, but still couldn't decide whether or not, you know, you believed in whether or not there was a future tribulation, and I wanted to ask, you know, where you stood on the question of that.
Well, the trouble with answering that question is the word tribulation is used more than one way in the Bible, and so it can be understood sometimes to refer to a future period of tribulation, or it can simply refer to tribulation in general, that is trouble, which is sort of a continuing constant phenomenon in the world. Like when Jesus said in John 16:33, in the world you will have tribulation, he said to his disciples. That's the same word that people use when they talk about the Great Tribulation. In the world, you Christians will have tribulation. He's not talking about a period of time. He's just talking about in the world, that's a condition you'll face. So this makes it sometimes difficult to answer that question. In my own understanding, I believe that there is trouble, if that's what we mean by tribulation, there is trouble for the church in the future. And in that case, I do believe in future tribulation. Now, if someone says, do you believe in a future seven-year tribulation period? I'd have to say, I'm going to have to see more scriptural evidence for that before I can affirm that, because I don't find even one verse in the Bible that mentions a seven-year tribulation. When we talk about a period of tribulation that many people identify with a future seven-year tribulation, there's really only twice in the Bible that that word is used referring to a period of tribulation. Once is in Matthew 24:21, where Jesus said, then there shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the world began, neither shall ever be. And then the other place is in Revelation 7:14, where John sees a great company that no one could number coming up out of the great tribulation, it says. So we've got Jesus talking about a great tribulation. He does not say how long it will take or how long it will last. Likewise, Revelation sees people coming up out of great tribulation. It also does not say how long it will last. Now, there are some time indicators in the book of Revelation, and they always point to 3.5 years. I was taught when I was younger that there are 2 periods of 3.5 years. And if you put them together end to end, you've got a period of 7 years, of course. And maybe that's true, but Revelation doesn't say that. What Revelation does do is it mentions a period of 3.5 years, and it mentions it 5 different times. It does not say there are 2 such periods, or 5 such periods, or 4, or 3, or 1. Certainly, a person reading the book of Revelation could easily come away with the impression that there's 1 period of 3.5 years that is frequently mentioned. So there's ambiguity there. Now, the idea of a 7-year tribulation has come from one particular passage which doesn't mention tribulation, and that is in Daniel 9. In Daniel 9, we have the prophecy of the 70 weeks. Each week is 7 years. Some people believe that one of those weeks, that is, one of those periods of 7 years, has not yet occurred. And they would apply that to the tribulation of the end times. Therefore, they come with the idea that the tribulation of the end times is the 70th week of Daniel, and therefore it must be 7 years long. I certainly taught that and believed that for many years. The problem is I later studied Daniel chapter 9 and found out there's not the slightest hint that there's a future 70th week. According to Daniel chapter 9, the 70 weeks will run their course, as near as we can tell, consecutively. And they began back in the days of Daniel, and they ran out in the days of Christ. So I don't find any evidence in Daniel or anywhere else in Scripture that there is a 70th week remaining to be fulfilled. The idea that there is a view of called dispensationalism, and I don't hold that view. Now, it may seem like I'm talking all around the issue. I'm actually telling you this. I don't know how long a period of tribulation may be in the future. I don't find a clear teaching in Scripture about a 7-year tribulation, really anywhere. I do believe that Jesus spoke of a tribulation that would happen in that generation that he was living in, that would happen, that his disciples would see in that generation. He told them, when you see this, do this. So, I do believe there's a past tribulation, and whatever future tribulation there may be, I believe is very ambiguous in Scripture. I do personally think that the Bible indicates that the church will face great trouble in the end times. And that's about all I can say with certainty based on scripture. You know, if I held the view I was raised with, I could certainly give much more certain answer. It just wouldn't be necessarily scripturally founded.
Okay. And you answered the other question I was going to ask then about whether or not the tribulation that was spoken of, say, for instance, in Matthew 24, had taken place already. So I greatly appreciate that, Steve.
All right, brother. It's good to hear from you, Duane.
Thank you so much, sir. God bless you and Merry Christmas, sir.
Same to you. God bless you, too. Okay, we'll talk to Dwight from Denver, Colorado. Dwight, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. A comment on Deuteronomy 10, 14, and 15, and I'm using the New American Standard Version. It says, "Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the highest heavens, the earth and all that is in it. Yet on your fathers did the Lord set his affection to love them, and he chose their descendants after them, even you, above all peoples as it is this day." Now, that seems to indicate to me that there's no other life in the universe, or if there is, that it's not other intelligent life that God has set his affection on. Do you see that in those verses?
Well, when God says that he chose them alone and their fathers to delight in them and set his love on them, I think he's talking about Israel. So this is not necessarily a statement about the human race on this planet. It's talking about Israel. I think the issue of whether there's life on other planets is, to my mind, an open question, but I, like yourself, I doubt it. I think the Bible would indicate that this earth and the affairs of this earth have been the focal concern of God in creation. In fact, it says in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 14 that when God made the stars, he made them to give light on the earth, which to my mind indicates that, you know, the earth is the significant planet that he chose to do something on. Now, you know, there's a possibility, one could argue, that he also made other planets at the same time and intended for the stars to give light on them and on the earth. In other words, he could be telling us that the stars are there to give us light, but not meaning exclusively. You know, they could be giving light to other planets, too, that we don't know about. I don't think so, but what I think isn't, you know, authoritative. My own impression is that God has not... He either has not made life on other planets, or if he has, it isn't our concern, because he hasn't chose to tell us about it.
Okay. Yeah. And if I could briefly, what is your opinion of street preaching as a, you know, as an outreach?
You know, I'll tell you what, back in the 70s in the Jesus movement, there were a lot of my friends who preached on the streets, and I have to say, I really admired them because I thought they had a lot of guts, and I always wished I could do that, because they'd stand there and they'd be shouting out the gospel in a public place, and people would be cursing them and looking at them with disdain and rejecting them. And I remember thinking, boy, those guys really have got some backbone. They must really love God. I sure wish I could do that. And it seemed to me like that was the epitome of being sold out for God, that you get on the street and shout at people. And then I read in Matthew, where Matthew is talking about Jesus, and he quotes from Isaiah 42. And in the quote, and let me see if I can turn there real quickly here. This is Matthew 12:18. He's quoting from Isaiah. It says, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit upon him. He will declare justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoking flax he will not quench, till he sends forth justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will trust." I thought, well, that's interesting that Matthew, who's describing the ministry of Jesus, says that the way Jesus did things fulfilled this prophecy that people would not hear his voice in the streets. And I went looking through the Gospels and the book of Acts, and found that Jesus really didn't go out in the streets and preach. We do find that he preached in the open air. He preached on the hillsides, and he preached wherever people would gather. But that's just the point. They gathered. He preached to people who gathered to hear him. And sometimes it was in the synagogue, sometimes it was in the open air. But he didn't go out to people who were not interested and start shouting at them. What he did was he depended on the fact that people were curious to hear what he had to say already. Something else had made them curious. Maybe they'd heard about a miracle. Or maybe he was just famous and people wanted to hear what he had to say. But when he saw that the crowds had gathered, he began to teach them. And it is slightly different than going out to a situation where people are not interested, their hearts are not prepared by God, they just find it an annoyance. And sometimes the street preacher might think, well, I'm being rejected because of the offense of the cross. Well, no, it might be the offense of the preacher. I mean, the preacher might be offensive. I've certainly heard preachers who sounded very abrasive out on the streets. And I'm not saying that street preaching would never be the right thing to do. But I have come to the conclusion that it's not necessarily something modeled in Scripture. The apostles, if they preached in the open air at all, did so to crowds that had gathered. Like on the day of Pentecost, there were people speaking in tongues. The crowds were curious. They gathered and said, what's going on here? And Peter took advantage of the situation and preached to them there, apparently in the open air, at least my opinion is. So I would say that open air preaching has its place, but usually in the Bible, it occurs as, you know, people have gathered and are interested in hearing what the preacher has to say. That's my take on it, and I could be not seeing it all that clearly, but that's what I think. We're out of time, unfortunately, for today's broadcast. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills to stay on, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.